So last time we started talking about slavery, and we basically made it through talking about how you can the different ways that the New Testament allows for you to be a slave, and that would be that if you had sold yourself for some reason, either because you were in extreme poverty or because you were surety for your debt or somebody else's debt. I think that was the two. Poverty, and basically if you're in poverty or you're in debt, you could sell yourself. And be somebody's slave, and but we saw that the New Testament forbids man stealing, which is kidnapping, go stealing somebody and making them your slave, then that is not allowed, and so the New Testament would forbid something like that, much like the slavery that we had in this country, at least the slavery that came about by us going and stealing people, or buying stolen property, as far as that goes. I want to spend about half the time today talking about what the rest of the New Testament has to say about slavery, and then spend the last half or maybe third getting into what the Old Testament has to say about it. Though we're not under the Old Testament, I think it's just interesting to go back and review the laws that were given for slavery in the Old Testament, and just to see, and honestly, some of the stuff you'll read and you'll be like, well, that just doesn't sound right to me. But I got an answer for that too. We'll get into this. What I want to show today is that there is a difference between a slave and a servant, and we're going to talk mostly about servants today. So let's look at some of the definitions. The definition of a slave, I read it last time, but I'll read it again since it was a couple weeks ago. It says, one who is the property of and entirely subject to another person, whether by capture, purchase, or birth, a servant completely divested of freedom and personal rights. Now contrast that with a servant, and you'll see that there are some similarities, but there are some stark differences as well. A servant is a person of either sex who is in the service of a master or mistress, one who is under obligation, and that's important, obligation, I'm going to define that in a second, one who is under obligation to work for the benefit of a superior and to obey his or her commands. It's a personal or domestic attendant, one whose duty it is to wait upon his master or mistress or do certain work in his or her household. The usual sense when no other is indicated by the context, sometimes with the defining word as domestic servant. So the key to this is a servant is one that's under obligation to work in the service of a master. Now, obligation may sound like an involuntary thing, but it's actually not an involuntary thing. It is voluntary by definition. Let's see it. Obligation, the primary definition, is the action of binding oneself by oath, promise, or contract to do or forbear something, an agreement whereby one person is bound to another, or two or more persons are mutually bound, also that to which one binds oneself, a formal promise. You see, it's complete. An obligation is completely voluntary. If you're obliged, if you're obligated to do something, it's because you have agreed to do that. That's why you're obligated to do it, because you have signed on to a contract. So you have a mortgage, you're obligated to pay it because you signed up for it. You know, nobody forced you to sign the paperwork or anything like that. So that's a clear difference between a servant who is under obligation and a slave who is the property of somebody else, and they're not under obligation. They must do it, and it's not, there's no choice in the matter for them whatsoever. A master is one having direction or control over the action of another or others, a director, leader, chief, commander, a ruler, governor. So in that, a servant was one who does service to a master. A master is one who has control of other people. So master-servant relationship there. Now notice that a servant is under obligation to work for the benefit of another. That's what makes a servant, the fact that he's under that obligation. An obligation is something that one enters into voluntarily and subjects oneself to. A servant works for and obeys another person, as we saw the definition bore out there. Therefore, a servant in a strict sense is one who voluntarily works for and obeys another person for his benefit. And that's the difference, like I said, between a servant and a slave. A servant voluntarily works for somebody else. He signs the contract or whatever, And most of us are servants in that sense, and I'll get to that here presently. Now, a slave, on the other hand, is the property, and I kind of got ahead of myself. The slave, on the other hand, is the property of another, and has no freedom or personal rights, as we saw in the definition. Every slave is a servant, but every servant is not a slave, right? So it's one of those things where one encompasses the whole thing, but one is a stricter definition of it, or a stricter part of it. Every slave is a servant, but not every servant is a slave. Now, every person who is an employee of an employer is a servant, by definition. I'll give you some definitions here of employee. Now, this word obviously is not found in the scripture, but we'll see that it is a synonym of servant. You got to define a few words here to get down to it, but we'll get there. An employee is a person employed for wages. It's something that is employed. Okay, so in that an employee is somebody that is employed. Employed is that is in another's employ. Okay, so that really settles that one, doesn't it? So employ, the noun, is the action of employing a person or making use of a thing. Employment. So just all this circular defining here, we will eventually get down to the bottom of this. So in that employ is the action of employing a person or its employment. Employment is the action or process of employing, the state of being employed, the service of a person. So now we're getting somewhere. The service of a person. Now, it said it's the action of or process of employing. So first I'll define employ, the verb, and then I'll define service. So the verb to employ is to use the services of a person in a professional capacity or in the transaction of some special business to have or maintain persons in one's service. So to employ is to have one serve you, to have a person in your service. And service is the condition of being a servant. So there we finally have it. We've gotten down like through five definitions, and we finally get to the place where an employee is a servant. So I told you I'd get there. The condition of being a servant, the fact of serving a master, the condition, station, or occupation of being a servant. It's the work or duty of a servant, the action of serving a master, performance of the duties of a servant, attendant of servants, work done in obedience to and for the benefit of a master, which service and servant have very similar definitions. And lastly, employer, because it said here somewhere, he's in the employment of an employer, somewhere anyway. I don't remember. I'm not seeing it right now. Anyway, an employer is one who employs. It's one who employs servants, workmen, etc. for wages. So an employer has servants. So you're a servant. I'm a servant. I guess you are not. You're a free man because you have your own business. You're a servant. So, and you too will be someday. Or maybe you'll be entrepreneurs. I don't know. So anyway, Steve's free. I'm a bond man to Mathnasium. Half time anyway. So I'm a half free man, and you're a complete bond man. So, okay, anyway, I'm Christ's servant anyway, so I'm still a servant. The New Testament allows for people to be servants of others, as we will see here in just a second. Now, servants are supposed to be obedient to their masters, according to the New Testament. So finally, to the Bible, in Ephesians 6 and verse 5, we have really about three or four main texts we're going to go to. There's one in Ephesians, one in Colossians, one in 1 Peter, and then there's one in 1 Timothy too. So we'll be spending some time in those for a little bit here. So Ephesians 6 and verse 5 says, "Servants, be obedient to them that are your masters according to the flesh, with fear and trembling, and singleness of your heart as unto Christ." So far from forbidding servitude, the New Testament gives laws regulating it. It certainly doesn't forbid the idea of serving somebody else or being somebody else's servant. Obviously not. In Colossians 3 and verse 22. Colossians 3:22 says, "Servants, obey in all things your masters according to the flesh, not with eye service as men pleasers, but as singleness of heart, fearing God." So we're supposed to obey, and I'm going to draw some other points out of these later, but I just wanted to get that point that these servants are supposed to obey their masters, and likewise, 1 Peter 2 and verse 18. 1 Peter 2:18, "Servants, be subject to your masters with all fear, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the froward." So not just to the good bosses, not just to the nice employers, but to all of them. Even if they treat you like crap, you're still supposed to be subject to them and serve them as...
What is froward?
Oh, froward?
Yeah. I heard it in another...
Yeah, it's... yeah, froward is an old word that means... let me get a definition. Anybody have a good...
Like
perverse. Perverse, thank you, yeah. There's nothing froward or perverse in them, yeah. Yeah, so something perverse is not forward. It's, froward. Yeah, it's an older English word. Yeah, so not a nice... You know, a froward master is a guy that's not a nice master. Geez, you know, some kind of a... Not exactly an honest kind of a guy. The look on your face was kind of funny because I thought you were like, what? I don't have to obey a mean boss?
Right.
So, anyway. So even if the boss isn't a nice guy, you know, even if he treats you like crap and he talks down to you and everything else, I mean, we're still supposed to obey him, if for no other reason, for Christ's sake. You know, because we're serving Christ, and it won't go unnoticed by God that if you, for conscience sake, obey a jerk of an employer. Now, servants should serve their masters as if they're serving Christ. So let's go back to Ephesians 6 again. Ephesians 6, we'll read 5 through 7 this time. "Servants, be obedient to them that are your masters according to the flesh, with fear and trembling, in singleness of your heart, as unto Christ. Not with eye service as men pleasers, but as the servants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, with good will doing service as to the Lord and not to men." So when we're serving those employers of ours, we serve them as if we're serving Christ. There is no menial job. There is no deadbeat job that, oh, this job is so, you know, I'm flipping burgers at McDonald's. This is way beneath my ability. Therefore, I don't have to do it. I don't have to do a good job. I'm just going to kind of go in there and have a bad attitude about it because this kind of works beneath me anyway. And this is a low-life corporation and my boss is a jerk and blah, blah, blah. No, you still... have to, you do it as if you're serving God. So whatever you do, whatsoever you do, do it heartily, as unto the Lord and not unto men. And I think that's my next verse in Colossians 3 and verse 23. Yep, and whatsoever you do, do it heartily, as unto the Lord and not unto men. And it just doesn't, like I said, it doesn't really matter what the job is. The important thing is that you do your best. And I think about my job now, I mean, I make a fraction of what I used to make. You know, back as an engineer, I mean, it's like, in a way, I mean, I could sit back and say, this is ridiculous. You know, here I'm working for peanuts, basically, and, you know, why should I try hard at what I'm being paid, you know, next to nothing compared to what I used to make. But, you know, I mean, it's just, that's the wrong attitude to have. You know, serve them as you're serving Christ, and you do the best you can, and be the best employer you can. And this is really important for you young guys whenever you start working. Whatever job you get, do the best you possibly can. Go in there, show up early, stay late, do any crappy task that somebody asks you to do, and do it to the best of your ability, and the Lord will see it. He puts up one and setteth down another, and you'll be promoted, and you'll work your way up. It doesn't matter. Any job, even no matter if you're shoveling crap for the local farmer, any job, if nothing else, it's a stepping stone to another job. So one job leads to another one, or, I mean, even McDonald's is a great big corporation. You could work your way up through McDonald's. You could become a manager of a store and then a manager of a chain or of a franchise or whatever. I mean, you never know. I mean, the possibilities are unlimited. So even in a bad economy, just go do the best you can with whatever job you have. And if you want to get a better one, look for one, apply for one. But while you're there, do the best you can. And God will see it, and He will reward you. Ephesians 6:8 tells us that very thing. "Knowing that whatsoever good thing any man doeth, the same shall receive of the Lord, whether he be bond or free." So you may not receive it from the employer, but you'll receive it from the Lord. The Lord, as it says, that promotion cometh not from the east or the west or the south, but the Lord setteth down, or putteth down one and setteth up another. You notice there was three directions, west, east, and south. One was left out. is north, because God's in the north. God putteth down one and setteth up another. In Colossians 3 and verse 24. Colossians 3:24, knowing that of the Lord ye shall receive the reward of the inheritance, for ye serve the Lord Christ. So it's not going to, your good work is not going to go unnoticed with God anyway. His eyes go to and fro throughout the whole earth, beholding the good and the evil. Now servants who are, quote, under the yoke should honor their masters. Go to 1 Timothy 6 and verse 1. On this topic, I was going to forward this to you, Chris, although you're not old enough yet. You have to be a senior in high school, but there's this guy, he's come up with this scholarship. I don't remember what it is. I should forward it to you anyway, just so in the back of your mind, maybe in a couple years. But I wish I could remember who the guy was. Anyway, what he's done is he's trying to give kids, students, scholarships to get jobs that are actually out there, like in technology field and things like that. But you have to sign, well, I forget what it's called. But anyway, you have to sign, it's an acronym. You sign this thing. You basically agree that you will, that no job is menial, that you'll work as hard as you can in any job, that nobody owes you anything, that, you know, you're basically going to go there and you're going to work as hard as you can at whatever job you have. And there's like five different things anyway. You sign this thing, and it's a large scholarship that he gives out anyway to students that will sign that and take that pledge. So it may be something you would be interested in if it's still around in a couple years. 1 Timothy 6 and verse 1. You know, the Bible says in all labor there's profit. So there is no bad job. You know, there's no job that's beneath you. 1 Timothy 6 and verse 1. Let as many servants as are under the yoke count their own masters worthy of all honor, that the name of God and his doctrine be not blasphemed. So a servant that's under the yoke, which means he's in some kind of bondage to a master, he is maybe obliged, or maybe, you know, in some kind of a thing where he was sold because of a debt or something like that, but he's under the yoke, he's supposed to give his master all honor, especially if that master is a believer, and we'll get into that in a second, actually right now, after I define this term. Yoke. It says them that are under the yoke. When you're speaking figuratively, we're not talking about, you know, more than likely he's not talking about men with the wooden thing on their neck, you know, next to the guy beside him dragging the plow or something like that. More than likely we're speaking figuratively here, obviously. It's denoting servitude, subjection, restraint, humiliation, oppression. So it figuratively means what it would be like if you were under a literal yoke, you know, when you're dragging a plow. You would be under servitude and subjection and restraint. We should not despise our masters if they're believers. For 1 Timothy 6 and verse 2, the next verse, and they that have believing masters, let them not despise them because they are brethren, but rather do them service because they are faithful and beloved, partakers of the benefit. These things teach and exhort. So, as a preacher, Paul's telling me to teach and exhort these things. So it's probably a good thing that I'm doing it, because he specifically says, teach these things and exhort. So that's what I'm doing tonight. Might not be the most popular thing that gets preached, but it needs to be. Masters must treat their servants well. So it goes both ways. You know, the servant is supposed to give honor to the master, but the master is also supposed to treat the servant well. Ephesians 6 and verse 9. So, let's hope that we work for Christian or at least somewhat moral people that would take these kind of commandments seriously and that would treat us well when we work for them. Because, you know, if you have a, like we read in 1 Peter, a froward master, he probably is not going to listen to God when God tells him to treat you good. Ephesians 6 and verse 9, and ye masters, do the same things unto them, forbearing threatenings, or threatening, knowing that your master also is in heaven, neither is there respect of persons with him. So if you're an employer, you know that your employer is in heaven, and you better treat your employees good, or God won't treat you good. You'll reap what you sow. Now, notice that these servants here that we've been looking at are paid what is fair by their masters. In Colossians 4 and verse 1, this is a paid position. So these clearly are not people that were that are working against their will. They're not that kind of slave. These are paid servants. Colossians 4 and verse 1, Masters, give unto your servants that which is just and equal, knowing that ye also have a master in heaven. So they're supposed to give them just and equal pay, whatever is right. So if they're doing a job that deserves $10 an hour, pay them $10 an hour, whatever. Whatever is just and equal and right. Now, think about this. If they're to be given what is just and equal, then they therefore have personal property, and they're not the property of their master, and therefore they're not slaves. Because a slave is the property of a master. If you're giving to somebody what is just and equal, that means that he has personal property. Obviously, you are paying him, so therefore he has money and possessions, whatever that money would buy. So he's not a slave in that sense. He's a paid servant. They are servants that do service to their masters, just like people today who are employees of an employer. So, I mean, these verses here can, without even a stretch, can absolutely apply to people just like us that are employees of employers. We're paid what the market would say is just and equal for our services. We're in the service of a master. We do obey them and do what they tell us to while we're there. So, I mean, these verses absolutely apply to each one of us today. The employee is the servant of the employee. The employee is the servant and the employer is the master. This is not referring to servants who were slaves in the sense of being the possessions of their masters, whom they stole or bought after he was stolen, since they were paid, and such a thing is condemned elsewhere in Scripture. So let me say that. I read it. Let me say it. So this isn't referring to slaves for two reasons. Number one, they're paid. I don't know of any slaves that were paid for their labor if you were, you know, taken or sold because of your debt or something like that. I mean, you're not paid. You're paying off a debt. And secondly, as I've said before, this is not referring to slaves that were stolen or kidnapped or anything else because that's elsewhere forbidden. Now, God says to abide in the condition that we are in when we were called, either as a servant or as a free man. So if you are called as a servant, and so you were unconverted, you become a Christian and you're a servant, there's no reason for you to say, oh, well, now I'm a Christian and I should be free and I'm not going to be any man's servant anymore. Well, that's not the case. I mean, we're supposed to abide in the same calling that we're in. And if we can get out of it, take the opportunity. And I'll get into that in just a second. 1 Corinthians 7:20-21. 1 Corinthians 7:20, let every man abide in the same calling wherein he was called. Art thou called being a servant? Care not for it. But if thou mayest be free, use it rather. So if you can be free, go ahead and do that. But abide in the same calling that you're in. There's clearly, from this passage and the other ones we've looked at, there's clearly nothing wrong with being a servant, even if you're a Christian. So you can be a Christian, you can be a servant of another man. Nothing wrong with that whatsoever. Though these verses contrast being a servant with being free, they're not necessarily referring to slaves, as we saw the definition of a servant bears out, because he says there, art thou called being a servant, so he's not necessarily referring to a slave that's in bondage. It could be just referring to an employee, for that matter. If one is a voluntary servant, which is an employee, he's still not free in the areas and conditions in which he's agreed to serve his master, the employer. So, I mean, he's still not free, you know, because Paul contrasts here the servant with being free. So the servant in this context is not free, but when you're at Valspar, you're not free. You know, I mean, when you're there, at least, you're supposed to do whatever they tell you to do, and you're under obligation to work a certain amount of hours and do certain things. And when I'm at Mathnasium, I'm certainly not free. You know, during those hours, I do whatever he tells me to. Literally, he says, go clean the toilet. I clean the toilet. You know, I mean, I do whatever I'm told. So I'm not free, at least in that restricted sense. Employees must obey their employers and are not free to do as they please, as I basically just said. Even if a servant is a slave, which sold himself to a master due to poverty, excessive debt, or being surety for someone else's debt, there's still nothing wrong with it. I mean, these verses, what we've seen here, would not forbid being a slave in that case if you were in that condition because of excessive debt or poverty or whatever. These verses are not condemning that. Now, in either case, a servant, which is an employee or a slave, if the person has the opportunity to be free, they should opt for it. So, you know, I mean, if I was a slave, I would probably want to be free if I had the opportunity. Though, I mean, there were some slaves, I think, in the South that didn't want to be free. They chose not to leave because they had good masters, they took care of them, they had a place to live, a place to sleep, they were fed and everything else, and they thought they apparently had a better deal than they would have on the outside, and they chose to stay. And we'll see, I don't know, either today or next week, we'll see in the Old Testament, that was an option for Old Testament slaves and servants too, that after, if it was a Hebrew bondservant, after 6 years he had to let him go. But if the guy said, hey, I love my master and I want to stay, then he takes him up against the post of the door, puts an awl through his ear, and he was a servant forever. I don't know if you remember that or not, but we'll go over that, I think, today yet. So anyway, you know, some people might want to be free, but I would think most would, or might want to remain a slave, I mean, but I would think most would want to be free. And Paul says that if you can, then do it. Take the opportunity. And, you know, if you have the opportunity to take a good entrepreneurial opportunity and get out from under the yoke of your employer, you know, if you want to be free, get to work 16 or 18 hours a day and make nothing for the next 10 years and have a 90% chance of failure, go be free. So anyway, that's about what it is when you're self-employed. That's usually how it happens. That's why there's more employees than employers, because it's not very easy. Everybody thinks, oh, it would just be great to be the boss. Yeah, well, go try it sometime. See how easy it is. We're all servants one way or the other, either of men or of the Lord or of both. 1 Corinthians 7:22. For he that is called in the Lord, being a servant, is the Lord's free man. Likewise also he that is called being free is Christ's servant. So it doesn't matter. You're either a servant of man, a servant of Christ, or a servant of both. You're never going to get away with not being anybody's servant. So you're always under somebody's accountability and under somebody's authority, either way. We should never be the servants of men in the same way that we're the servants of Christ, though. I mean, there's a difference between serving men like serving Christ. Yeah, we're supposed to serve them as if we're serving Christ, but we're not servants of men religiously or spiritually or anything like that. No man has the key to our eternal salvation, and therefore we serve him like a lot of Catholics did the Pope. You know, they're scared to death of the man. They literally think that he has the keys of hell and death of their own soul. But we're not supposed to serve any man like that. It says there in 1 Corinthians 7:23, ye are bought with a price, be not ye the servants of men. So in one, out of one side of his mouth, Paul says that if you're a servant, care not for it. And then he says, don't be the servants of men. So you put two and two together. There are certain ways in which you are not supposed to be the servant of men, because you're the servant of Christ. So not spiritually, not religiously, or anything like that. So I'm just going to summarize the prohibitions and allowances for slavery or servitude in the New Testament. So kind of recap what we covered the last 2 weeks, just to make sure everybody's got it. So first of all, the New Testament forbids kidnapping, or men stealing, as the Bible calls it, and therefore prohibits the type of slavery in which a person is stolen or forced into servitude, such as was the case with much of the slavery in the U.S. up to and including the 19th century. So this, before the War of Northern Aggression, or the Civil War, as some people call it, before that, that type of slavery, most of it anyway, would have been forbidden in the New Testament because it was man-stealing. We went over and stole people and shipped them over in these terrible ships, and half of them died on the way over and everything. It was just absolutely awful in the way that those people were treated. Secondly, the New Testament does allow for a person to be bond, which is in the state of serfdom or slavery, not free in bondage. So it does allow for a person to be bond. This state of bondage could be the result of selling oneself to be another man's servant because one was in extreme poverty, or selling oneself, or being sold to be another man's servant because one was in excessive debt, or selling oneself or being sold to be another man's servant because one was surety for another man's debt, which means you co-signed on his loan, basically, and he couldn't pay, and now you're going to pay, and if you don't have the money to pay, well, I'm going to take it out of your hide, basically. So the New Testament would allow for all three of those, allow for servitude and bondage in those three conditions. The New Testament also allows for a person to voluntarily become another man's servant in exchange for compensation, such as an employee and employer relationship. So there you have it. That is a summary of the New Testament of what is allowable and not allowable when it comes to, quote, slavery. Now, let's just take a look here briefly. I'm not going to get too far into this, at what the Old Testament has to say about slavery. And like I said, I think if for no other reason, just for education's sake, this will be good to go through. If somebody ever brings this up with you and challenges you about the Bible being true because it promotes or condones slavery, I guarantee you they're going to bring up these Old Testament passages. So it's important that you know they're there. It's important that you know what they say. It's also important, with the first couple points I'm going to make, is to know what the answer is to that argument. And the answer is that we're not under that testament anymore. That testament also called for the stoning of somebody that picks up sticks on Saturday. We don't kill people that pick up sticks on Saturday anymore. So, I mean, we're not under those laws unless they're repeated again, and I'll get into that in just a second. But the first thing to remember is that law, that Old Testament, was given to Israel. It was given by Moses to Israel and to only to Israel, to no other person, or no other nation, pardon me. In Psalm 147, 19 through 20. This is such a misunderstood idea. I mean, it's almost universally misunderstood in Christianity, I think, of what the purpose of the Old Testament was and what the Christian's relationship to it is under the New Testament. It's extremely misunderstood. Psalm 147, 19 through 20. Since he showeth his word unto Jacob, his statutes and his judgments unto Israel, he hath not dealt so with any nation. And as for his judgments, they have not known them. Praise ye the Lord. He had not dealt so with any other nation. He gave that law to Jacob, which is Israel. And that's it. Not to the Amorites, not to the Moabites, not to any of the other ites of any kind. What were some of the other ones? The Amalekites, the Jebusites, the Hittites, there you go, Hivites. None of them. It wasn't given to any of those nations. It was only given to Israel. And then the psalmist says, praise ye the Lord. Like, he's thankful for this, that it was only given to Israel. So it's absolutely clear that they did not know God's judgments. In the Old Testament, I think if we've been through this once in the last 6 months, probably at least a dozen times, it seems like for some reason in every study this comes up for some reason. But I'm just going to briefly say the Old Testament was abolished by the death and resurrection of Christ. So when Christ came and instituted the New Testament, the Old Testament was abolished and done away. Okay, so since I've told you this so many times, who knows the verse? Anybody? Chapter? Anybody? How about the book?
Hebrews?
That's one of them. No. Which chapter?
I'm going to say 9. But...
9 might be one. 8 is definitely one of them. I think there is one in 9, too. How about any other ones?
I'm thinking the one that waxeth old.
That's Hebrews 8. Yep, that's Hebrews 8. Okay. Yep. So you were close. Very good. Anybody else got any other ideas? How about one of Paul's epistles? How about in the epistle that was after 1 Corinthians?
Oh, yeah, 2 Corinthians.
2 Corinthians, yeah. Yeah, 2 Corinthians 3. That's probably the most clear cut that just flat out says that it's abolished. So 2 Corinthians 3. And I'm not going to read the whole passage. I have here in the outline 6 through 13. I'll tell you what, I'm just going to read 7, 11, and 13. It says, but if the ministration of death written and engraven in stones was glorious, so that the children of Israel could not steadfastly behold the face of Moses for the glory of his countenance. Now, what is that talking about there? Anybody remember?
The tablets.
The tablets, right? The stone tablets up on Mount Sinai and everything. Talking about the Ten Commandments, the stone tablets. The rest of that verse. Which glory was to be done away? Jump down to verse 11. For if that which is done away was glorious, how much or much more that which remaineth is glorious. Talking about the New Testament. It says the Old Testament is done away there. And one more, verse 13. And not as Moses, which put a veil over his face, that the children of Israel could not steadfastly look to the end of that which is abolished. So that Old Testament, and that's speaking of the stone tablets, the Ten Commandments, it is abolished. And I've said this 100 times. 9 of those Ten Commandments are repeated again in the New Testament. So 9 of those Ten Commandments are still binding upon us today. Except for which commandment? Sabbath. There we go. Except for the Sabbath. That one is not repeated. And as a matter of fact, we're told to let no man judge us in respect of it. We're not even supposed to allow somebody to get on us for not keeping it. The Old Testament, the Law of Moses, was added for transgressions till the seed should come to whom the promise was made. That's in Galatians 3 and verse 19. Galatians 3 and verse 19. It says, wherefore then serveth the law? It was added because of transgressions till the seed should come to whom the promise was made, and it was ordained by angels in the hand of a mediator. So now, if it was added till the seed should come, whom the promises were made to, and that seed was Christ, when Christ comes, what's that tell you about the law? It's not there anymore. It was only added till or until the seed should come. And I'll throw in another one there just for fun, because I like busting on premillennialism anytime I have a chance. It says there, wherefore then serveth the law? It was added because of transgression. But what do the dispensationalists say was added because of transgression? They say the gospel came to the Jews and they received it not, so God gave the gospel, or the kingdom, the offering of the kingdom came to the Jews. They refused it, so then God added the gospel because of the transgression of the Jews for a while. This says that the Old Testament was added because of transgressions. Schofield says that the gospel was added because of transgressions. So Jesus or Schofield, I'm probably going to pick Jesus. I think he knows what he's talking about. And then Ephesians 2 and verse 15. I think we already covered that one. I don't need to beat a dead horse here. Let's jump to Jason's verse, Hebrews 8 and verse 13, that just to show that the New Testament replaced the Old Testament. Anybody that wants to check those out, Ephesians 2:15 and Colossians 2:14 through 17, likewise show that the Old Testament was done away with at the cross. Hebrews 8 and verse 13 says, in that he saith a new covenant, he hath made the first old. Now that which decayeth and waxeth old is ready to vanish away. So at this point, as Paul's writing Hebrews, the Old Testament is ready to vanish away. The new covenant is coming in its place. And we see there in 2 Corinthians, by the time he writes that, he says it is done away with. It's already gone. So in reality or in actuality, it was done away with at the cross of Christ. In practicality, it kind of hung around and stuck around for another 40 years until the temple was completely destroyed and the Jews were dispersed. And so, you know, practically they kind of still had it, but it was officially done away with at the cross of Christ. Therefore, the law, if a law is not reiterated in the New Testament, then it's not binding on us today, as is the case with most of the rest of the verses I'm going to read for the next week and a half. Now, Israelites were able to buy servants who were foreigners for money. So look back there in Exodus 12 and verse 44. I think this stuff it's just kind of neat to study, and it's kind of neat to see how the laws were back then. And try to put yourself in their shoes and just think what it would have been like. I always find that fascinating. And not to mention, it says in Romans 15 that the things that were written aforetime were written for our learning, that we through patience and comfort of the scriptures might have hope. So, and then it says in 1 Corinthians 10 that, what's it say? It's a parallel verse. I don't want to go to it. I want to get it, but I can't remember. What things happened to them happened for examples. And are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come. 1 Corinthians 10:13. That was an absolutely pitiful job at quoting that verse. 1 Corinthians 10. At least I'm not hung out to dry. I can remember the verse reference, so that's better. It's not 13, it's 11. Now all these things happen unto them for ensamples, and they are written for our admonition, upon whom the ends of the world are come.
That's not too bad.
So, not too bad, yeah, it was close. Those two verses are so much similar, and I usually end up kind of amalgamating the two of them and getting them, you know, kind of meld two into one and botch them both up. But anyway, the point is, what I'm trying to say, is that the things that were written in the Old Testament were written for our learning, that we can look back on these things and we can gain lessons and examples, and we can, there's all kinds of stories back there of different people that different things happened to them, and we can go back there and we can look at those as examples and draw out spiritual parallels and all kinds of good stuff. So it's not like the Old Testament is worthless, that's for certain. So anyway, Exodus 12 and verse 44. It says, I'll tell you what, let's read 43 through 45 to get a little bit of context. And the Lord said unto Moses and Aaron, this is the ordinance of the Passover, there shall no stranger eat thereof. But every man's servant that is bought for money, when thou hast circumcised him, then shall he eat thereof. A foreigner and an hired servant shall not eat thereof. So if an Israelite had bought a servant for money, then that servant could eat of the Passover. But just a regular old foreigner that was not bought for money, he could not eat thereof. And what I've done in the rest of this study, I think, I basically went through the whole Old Testament. No, I didn't flip page by page. Obviously, there'd be a whole lot to read there. But I used my Bible program, and I searched every possible conceivable thing that I could think of. Servant, slave, master, bondman, anything like that I could think of. And then every time I'd find a passage, then I would start cross-referencing that passage with any other passage I could find. And I'm pretty sure that I basically have everything in this study that the Old Testament has to say about slavery, I think. So I could have missed something, obviously. But what I have not done is cherry-pick just certain things, you know, just to bring out the points that I wanted to or something. I got them all out, wrote them down on a piece of paper, and then categorized them all and tried to figure, you know, try to put them all together and give you a big, broad overview of everything the Old Testament has to say about slavery. So if I miss some, forgive me. Compare that with Leviticus 22 and verse 11. Leviticus 22 and verse 11. But if the priest buy any soul with his money, he shall eat of it, and he that is born in his house, they shall eat of his meat. So here the priest could buy a soul with money. He could buy a person for his slave, and they would eat in the priest's house, eat of the priest's food. Now Israelites could buy a Hebrew servant. So that was not speaking of a Hebrew servant there, but they could buy a Hebrew servant, which is one of their own kin. But they could only keep him 6 years, and then they had to let him go free on the seventh year. So look at Exodus 21 and verse 2. I remember hearing of Christian slaves in this country that were basically cling to these verses and hope that God would bless them with the same thing, that they would be on the seventh year, they would be set free. And I don't know if it always happened or not. Like I said, we're not under that law. But anyway, I guess that would probably be a hope that I would cling to if I was a slave and didn't want to be one. Exodus 21 and verse 2. If thou buy an Hebrew servant, 6 years shall he serve, and in the seventh he shall go out free for nothing. So in the other places, and I'm not sure where, it talks about if a Hebrew became poor, he could sell himself to somebody in the land. And that's what this is speaking of here. So when you bought him, you get him for 6 years, but then on the seventh, he'd go free. It doesn't matter how much you owed him. On the seventh year, he'd go free. It's kind of like the debts, and like if they had to sell a property at the year of Jubilee, everything would go back. So it doesn't matter if it was the 49th year, and the 50th year is the year of Jubilee. That's when it was every 50 years. And God even warned Israel, don't you say, we're getting close to the year of Jubilee, and I'm not gonna buy this guy's property. I'm not gonna do whatever because I'm gonna have to give it back. So anyway, you know, God had a resetting of everything back there. I guess that would stop big rich people from, you know, getting all the land up themselves. Maybe that was what God's plan was there. I don't know. Compare that with Deuteronomy 15 and verse 12. Deuteronomy 15 and verse 12 says, And if thy brother, an Hebrew man or an Hebrew woman, be sold unto thee and serve thee 6 years, then in the seventh year thou shalt let him go free from thee. So there you have it, the seventh year again. Now when they sent him out, though, it wasn't like, okay, I didn't get all my money out of you that I should have. I'm going to send you off with the clothes on your back, and you're going to have to go figure it out and you know, find some place to live and everything. No, that wasn't the case at all. They could not send him away empty. They had to send him away furnished liberally with possessions. In Deuteronomy 15 and verse 13, now why didn't I leave my book turned there? Deuteronomy 15 and verse 13, this is right after the verse we just read. And if thou sendest him out free from thee, thou shalt not let him go, or thou shalt not let him go away empty. Thou shalt furnish him liberally out of thy flock and out of thy floor, that would be the threshing floor with wheat and that kind of stuff, food, and out of thy wine press, of that wherewith the Lord thy God hath blessed thee, thou shalt give unto him. I think that's as far as I wanted to read there. Yeah, through verse 14. Now the master was supposed to send him away gladly, and God would bless him for it. So, you know, the master may be losing out. I mean, maybe the guy owed him 50 grand, and he only served him 6 years, and he couldn't really pay that off. But God says, let him go, and God would bless him for that. In verse 18 of Deuteronomy 15, it shall not seem hard unto thee when thou sendest him away free from thee, for he hath been worth a double hired servant to thee, in serving thee 6 years, and the Lord thy God shall bless thee in all thou doest. So God would bless the person that sent him away. And that always works. You do what God says, God will bless you. Don't worry about the results. Don't worry what it's going to cost me. Just do what he says, and he'll take care of that. He'll bless us if you do the right thing. Now, if the servant was single when he came, he would leave single. And if he was married when he came, he would take his wife with him. Exodus 21 and verse 3. Exodus 21, 3. And if he came in by himself, he shall go out by himself. If he were married, then his wife shall go out with him. Now, if the master gave him a wife, and he had children with her, he would be free to go, but the wife and children would be the master's. Now, everybody's thinking, wait a minute, that doesn't sound right to me. I got an answer for that. Exodus 21 and verse 4, next verse. If his master gave him a wife, and she bare him, and she have borne him sons or daughters, the wife and her children shall be her master's, and he shall go out by himself. Now you can imagine, I mean, that'd be pretty rough. If you go to be a guy's master, he gives you a wife, you have children, he says you can go, but they're staying. That'd be a pretty rough deal, right? Now, this law would seem unfair to some people, right? I mean, there are certain things I'll admit I read, and I'm like, God, that just doesn't really sound fair. But I don't question God. I'm just like, I'm just intellectually, that just doesn't really make sense to me. But as I will show you in a second, his ways are higher than our ways. His thoughts are not our thoughts. As the heavens higher than the earth, so are his thoughts above ours. But think about this before we even get into those verses. Keep in mind that this servant was a Hebrew, right? This is a Hebrew guy. He was a Jew and knew the law. So he would not have had to take the wife and have children. He knew the law. I mean, if he was a Hebrew, he knew this like the master knows it. So he knows whenever when the master says, hey, here, you want a wife? He could say, no, I don't want one because I don't want to have to leave her and the kids go, after 7 years. So he wouldn't have had to do it. Nobody's forcing him to do it. He could have always waited to marry until after he was free. So he had that prerogative. And like I said, Isaiah 55, 8 and 9, God's ways are higher than our ways. So when we find a law like this, and it kind of rubs us the wrong way, we don't like it, just always remember, God's ways are higher than ours. That's what I had to tell an atheist acquaintance of mine. Whenever he had an issue with God's miracles and the fact that he won't show him a sign that he'd believe. And I said, God doesn't have to operate according to the dictates of your will and whim. And if he did, he wouldn't be God. So anyway, cracks me up. You know, atheist conceives a God in his mind, which he doesn't even believe in, and then condemns the God that he's conceived in his mind because he doesn't give him miracles to believe in him. I mean, come on, go figure. So anyway, Isaiah 55. I've got atheists on the mind today. Mm-hmm. Isaiah 55, 8 and 9. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, neither are your ways my ways, saith the Lord. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. So God may not think the same way as we do about things, and guess what? He's right, and we're wrong. So if you don't like these laws, go pound sand. That's probably what God would say if he was, you know, going to use modern parlance. I don't want to put words in his mouth, but anyway, that's what I would say, and that's kind of what I would imagine that God's response would be to that kind of thing. You don't like it, lump it. And in Romans 3 and verse 4, it says, let God be true, but every man a liar. Romans 3 and verse 4. Paul says, God forbid, yea, let God be true, but every man a liar. And as we go through this next time, I'm going to be, and you'll see, there's going to be so many of these laws that we don't probably like, and my response each time is going to be, his ways are higher than our ways, his thoughts are higher than our thoughts, let God be true, but every man a liar. That's my response every time. All right, so two more points. Now, if the servant loved his master and his wife and children and didn't want to go free, then his master could take him before the judges, bore a hole in his ear with an awl, and he would be a servant for life. Isn't that nice? But the guy wasn't forced to do it or anything. If he liked the master, or if he was married, if the master had given him a wife and he had kids and he didn't want to leave, and that would be understandably so. I mean, I'd rather be somebody's servant than be jerked away from my wife and kids. So he could choose to stay, and they would go through a ritual. They'd give him an ear piercing, so everybody would know that he's the guy's servant forever. Exodus 21, 5 through 6. And if the servant shall plainly say, I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out free. Then his master shall bring him unto the judges. He shall also bring him to the door, and unto the door of the, or unto the door post. And his master shall bore his ear through with an awl, and he shall serve him forever. So an awl is like a pointy device, basically, like a little, I think it has like a little handle on it with a point. I'm pretty sure that's what an awl is. Anyways, they just take him up against, you know, put his ear lobe up against the doorpost and ram through it with an awl. He just looked like these modern idiots that have those posts anyway, you know, those great big gaping holes in their ears. He probably wouldn't put like a, you know, a 4-gauge piece of pipe in there like people do nowadays, but anyway, I suppose he probably could have. Deuteronomy 15, 16 through 17. This will be our closing text. I think, if I remember right, this basically says about the same thing. Maybe get an additional piece of information. I think David is upset in there. Deuteronomy 15, 16 through 17. It kind of sounds like he just had his ear rammed through with an awl or something. Be your servant forever. Deuteronomy 15, 16 through 17. Chris, you want to stick around here forever? Dad's probably got an awl somewhere. All right, Deuteronomy 15, 16 through 17. And it shall be, if he say unto thee, I will not go away from thee, because he loveth thee in thine house, and because he is well with thee, then thou shalt take an awl and thrust it through his ear unto the door, and he shall be thy servant forever. And also unto thy maidservant thou shalt do likewise. So it was for the female servants as well as the males. Now, as I said, these laws are not repeated in the New Testament. So we're not under these kind of laws. You can't have a servant and give him a wife and get to keep the kids and all that kind of stuff, and then, you know, ram an awl through his ear if he wants to stay. I mean, we don't have any of these laws today, so I'm sure everybody's breathing a sigh of relief, unless you wanted to get yourself a servant or something and in such cases, I guess. You're not allowed to buy any of your brethren anyway. So thanks for listening, and we'll finish this up next time, Lord willing.